welcome to this Election Day edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we hope that you have taken time today to vote. Speaking of the election, I'll catch up with Larry Chouinard, my high school social studies teacher. Could he teach me today like he could 40 years ago? We'll see what Larry is thinking about this election as he joins us here on Main Street. Plus, Tom Ezern stops by with another of his Plainsfolk essays, and we'll introduce Asian View. It's a new segment that airs weekday evenings here on Prairie Public. But first, we open our Main Street studio to an important discussion about Alzheimer's and dementia and the care that's available here in North Dakota. Joan Danks, she's the North Dakota Program Director for the Alzheimer's Association. Joan, in all honesty, I wish that I weren't welcoming you to Main Street, but the work you do is incredible and it's so necessary. So I will welcome you to Main Street.
Thank you so much, Craig. It's really my honor to be here.
Could you, as we begin, give us an overview of dementia and Alzheimer's in North Dakota?
Dementia and Alzheimer's disease, I want to first address that there is a difference. So Alzheimer's disease is a form of dementia, and there's many people living with a variety of forms of dementia. And so we do a lot of education with just disease in specifics across the United States and in North Dakota. My team here, we do a variety of education series to help with just spreading awareness and also reducing stigma. In North Dakota specifically, our stats, our figures, they say that there are nearly 14,000 people in the state of North Dakota living with Alzheimer's disease. So that's not including all other forms of dementia. And then in the state of North Dakota, we have nearly 19,000 caregivers. And a lot of those caregivers are people that are living at home with the person that is living with dementia. And so it's a huge portion of people in our state. And unfortunately, by the year 2050, it's projected to double.
So sorry to hear that, but I certainly understand that.
Yeah, it is. We were just talking briefly about people are living longer, and we have medical interventions that are keeping us healthier longer throughout our lifespan. And also, we have, as we age, our risk increases to develop some form of dementia. So, of course, those risks just continue as we age.
Do we know whether North Dakota has proportionally more or less numbers of folks who have dementia or Alzheimer's?
You know, that's a great question. Our state, we do have a higher number of aging and older adults, so our stats tend to show that. Now, I don't know all the stats for all of the other states, but certainly for North Dakota, we do have a high proportion.
Joan, can you share with us then an overview of the North Dakota Dementia Care Services Program and what goals you have and how you try to achieve those, not just in the bigger cities, but rural areas of North Dakota too?
Yeah, absolutely. That is the heart and soul of the work that we're doing here in North Dakota. So in North Dakota, we're very special because we have a grant that we receive through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services, which allows us to do some really incredible work that is honestly maybe not being done throughout the rest of the United States because we get this funding. And what the funding gives us the opportunity to do is provide what we call care consultation. And through care consultation, what we do is we meet with individuals face-to-face, in person. We can meet over the phone or virtually, but our team is trained and we understand dementia, we understand Alzheimer's, and we understand a lot of what it takes to care for people that are living with the disease. And so what we do in those meetings, in those care consultations, is we listen. We listen to what the struggles are at home. We listen to what problems may be going on. And we talk about solutions. We talk about resources within the state. We talk about having those difficult conversations. Maybe it's the conversation about retiring from driving. Maybe it's the conversation of ensuring that we have our financial and legal plans set so that we have the time to, you know, spend time with our loved ones or the people that we're caring for and not stressing about all those other details. Once those details are out of the way, then we can move on to the next thing. So whatever that looks like, we work with the people that are coming to us for those care consultations and really just providing resources and support. And also to ensure that they know that they're not alone, because they aren't. There are a lot of people in this state that are going through the same struggles or the same situation, maybe different from person to person or home to home. And it's really important for people to know that they're not alone, because we are here.
Joan, before we moved to North Dakota, we lived in southern Wyoming, and my mother-in-law lived about 20 minutes from us, and it was great. As she aged, we could kind of check in on her very easily. It was just a really wonderful time. But we moved here, and then she moved to Sheridan to be with my wife's sister. But during that time, she started to get worse. We felt that we were kind of on an island, not being right there. Could you have helped someone like me here in North Dakota, even though I have a family member elsewhere that's really struggling with these issues?
That is actually a wonderful question. So one of the things that we do with the Dementia Care Services Program is that we offer care consultation to the person living with dementia. That person actually does need to be living within the state of North Dakota. However, if there's family members outside of the state, they can join us virtually, or they can join us by phone through a care consultation. So that's a great distinction to make. The other thing is that just because the person living with dementia or Alzheimer's isn't living in the state, so we have, the Alzheimer's Association has a 1-800 number that is a 24/7 helpline. So if people need to speak with someone and want to have a care consultation virtually over the phone, they can do that anywhere across the United States.
Joan, we discovered going through this process that getting folks to help us in rural Wyoming was just really, really hard, that there weren't as many caregivers as were necessary, at least there. Is that the same in here in North Dakota?
You know, each state is different in the resources that they're able to provide. I am really happy to say that North Dakota does an excellent job of providing resources to rural communities. And also, it is challenging. We are in the midst of a workforce crisis. And so it is hard to find certain caregivers in certain parts of the state. However, there's resources. And so I would really encourage anyone to connect with us to discuss what those resources are. And everyone's resource needs are different. And so what we do in the Alzheimer's Association in our Dementia Care Services Program for North Dakota is we help identify what those resources are in rural communities, and we do our best to help get people help where they are. And so our staff, we will drive to anywhere in North Dakota to meet with a family in person in their home if they need. And that's something that we offer and we're happy to do.
Joan, I know that in my family, and I think maybe in everyone's family, we recognize that our parents are aging, but I don't know that I want to admit or realize that they have dementia, or maybe, you know, really need more care than I recognize. And then I'm guessing people come to you when they maybe should have come to you earlier. What advice can you give to folks that maybe in those shoes are saying, well, I don't know if grandma needs more help or not. I guess she's doing okay. I don't know.
Well, that's so common. And listen, this is what we really are trying to do, is we're trying to break down that stigma and help people learn and educate themselves about what are those warning signs? What can I do in my own life to help drive that risk reduction? Are there things that I can do to drive down my risk so that, you know, if I had a grandparent or a parent, or maybe I've had two, myself, my grandmother had dementia and my grandfather had Alzheimer's disease. And so I know the prevalence and what that means. So we do a lot of education. And one of the things that we talk about often is how to understand or recognize those warning signs. And there's actually 10 of them. And so what we do is we offer that education to everyone. Number one is, if you have concern, if you are thinking that maybe there's someone in your life that is maybe having some memory issues or struggling on a day-to-day basis to maintain their daily routines and structure, that's a warning sign. Something that disrupts everyday life where the person can't just quite finish a detail or complete a step. If they're getting lost in familiar places, maybe they drive to the grocery store, you know, all of the time, and they're driving to the grocery store and they just are getting confused and lost and can't find it. Challenges that they may have planning or solving problems that would be really easy for a person to do, that's another warning sign. Confusion with time and place. That's something that can be one of those first inklings, I would say.
It was something we noticed, Joan. It really was that, well, there's a clock right there. Oh, I feel so bad.
Yeah, you know, and it's okay. You know, one of the things that we want everyone to know is that you're not alone. Again, this happens to so many people. I think we can all name at least one person that we know, even if they may not be a direct relative. There's someone in our lives that we know that has gone through this, and it's scary. You know, I just want to be honest and real, is that it is scary, but there's help and there's resources. And the earlier that we detect and we have the conversations of, hey, you know, I've been concerned. I've noticed that, you know, you've been getting a little confused, or I've seen you.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. Right? I mean, the defenses go up. At least they did with my dad. No, I'm not. I can drive fine. Well, no, you can't, Dad. Well, yeah, I can.
Absolutely. And so what we would say in those moments is, you know, having that conversation, a sit-down conversation, a family should sit down, say, before you're going to have the talk. Sit down and discuss, okay, who's the best person to actually say something? Who would this message be well received from? And definitely not a big group conversation, because that puts up a person's defenses right away. But having someone that the person would trust and feel comfortable with to have that conversation, and just say, you know what, I would really help me to feel good about this is let's talk to your doctor. And, you know, do you have a doctor that you see often? And if so, let's see if they can help us with this and ask for a cognitive screen.
One of the things that we did in Wyoming was we learned that there are readiness to driving tests that physical or occupational therapists could give. And so both of our parents agreed to do those. And when the time came, agreed to kind of honor the results there. And that was helpful for us to, in one way, have someone else tell our parents what we recognized.
Yes, it's so important to seek advice from professionals, because it is a struggle and it can be a challenge to receive this information, say, from your child or from your grandchildren. However, when we look up to professionals in the community and we know that we can lean on them for support and guidance, sometimes those have the best outcomes. So I'm happy to hear that you did that, because that's a great way to kind of take the pressure off of the family and say, hey, this is what the doc said, or this is what our occupational therapist said. And, you know, just the reminder that we want you to stay safe. We want everyone around you to stay safe.
We're enjoying this important conversation with Joan Danks. She's the North Dakota Program Director for the Alzheimer's Association. Speaking of families, I'm sure, Joan, that you have seen times when members of a family weren't on the same page about mom and dad or about grandpa and grandma. And what advice do you give those families who might have differing views and opinions about the current state of things with their loved ones?
You know, I see this often, and family dynamics are a real thing. And so I would encourage a family to give each other grace, to take a step back and think about the big picture. And everyone's priorities typically are for the better, for the good of the person that's living with the disease. And so just take a breath, take a moment, try to listen to each other and problem solve best that you can. That is something that we do within our care consultations, is we do help with those family dynamics and helping to just kind of almost be a mediator sometimes. Because it's hard and there's a lot of stress put on people in a variety of settings, and it's not easy. So we want to be there for support.
Let me ask you this question, Joan. There might be some people listening who are wondering, okay, maybe our family needs extra support, extra help. I don't have the money to pay for this kind of thing. You know, we're a good, solid family. We get by, but I don't have this kind of extra cash around or extra way to pay for this stuff. What would you tell those folks?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy that you asked. So our services with Alzheimer's Association, we're a nonprofit. So everything that we do is free. So if you want to come and talk with us, it's going to cost you nothing. And so I'd really encourage you to do that. Now, in the state of North Dakota, we do have a really robust program with the Department of Health and Human Services, and they do help people. Now, sometimes it's a good amount of money, sometimes it's not, but they do help with respite care. And so what I would suggest is come talk with us and we can get the ball rolling and we can have those conversations and figure out what the best plan is.
Our family also navigated briefly this idea of hope through a clinical trial. And we started to get some information, decided maybe that it wasn't for us, but I think that there was in some members of our family an expectation that we got to do something. We've got to do this, you know. And that caused a little bit of friction, but how can you help families navigate that side of the picture? Because there is some research happening. There are clinical trials underway. Some maybe are better than others. What should we know about that?
Oh my goodness, Craig, you have the best questions. So yes, we at the association, I had mentioned that we're a nonprofit. Well, a large portion of our proceeds actually go to developing trials and helping researchers and scientists around the world. So one of the things that we do is you can go to our website and you can look at what we call trial match. And so what that does is it will connect you in this website to a variety of research programs. And so someone will connect with you, you fill out a form, they'll connect with you, and then they'll discuss with you what trial or research project would you fit into? And honestly, that is what is going to drive the opportunity for us to find a cure and for us to hopefully someday really stop and end Alzheimer's disease. Yeah, it's really wonderful. We've got 52 countries around the world that are helping us and researchers and scientists from around the world that are really focused to ending Alzheimer's disease.
Joan, if I'm a friend of someone who I recognize as maybe slipping in some regards, may show signs of dementia, how should I approach the family with what I've recognized maybe when they haven't yet?
Sure. I would just say have an honest conversation. Speak with, you know, one or two people, whoever you feel comfortable with, who you know well, and just let them know what you've seen. Maybe they don't spend as much time with a person or maybe they're busy and it's, you know, they're just not recognizing those things. Have the conversation. Start somewhere, express your concerns and, you know, that you're there for support. And any conversation that happens is just a step in the right direction.
Joan, lastly, as we kind of wrap up our conversation here, there comes a point, I think, with many families when as much as we want mom or dad to stay with us, we just can't do it. That's not a sign of failure. Joan, what advice do you give to folks who find themselves in those shoes?
Yeah, thank you, Craig. It is not a failure to seek help. Because when a person or a situation becomes maybe unsafe, or just you're just not able to do the best that you know you want them to have, the best care that you want them to receive, it's not a failure. It's just the next step. And so I would say, look at the options. Do your research. Definitely there's in-home care options and also facilities that do this, that specialize in this type of care that a person needs. I've worked in long-term care and skilled nursing, and I have seen many families come in and the stress that they finally are relieved of once they see that their person is living well and being cared for, and they can come and see what's happening in the facility and be a part of it. It really is a great option. And it's not always an option for everyone, but certainly doing your homework and researching places around that you potentially would like to look at, it really does help.
Lastly, Joan, what conversation should I have with my kids now? I'm in my early 60s, but my day's coming, right? I don't know if it's sooner or later, and I don't know if I'll have dementia or not, but I want to be prepared. What sort of things should we talk about now?
I love this question. You know what? Now, and we all are aging since the day we're born. And so one of the things that we want to really talk about with young kids is healthy living habits and healthy habits for our brains. So what can we do that's going to keep our bodies and our minds healthy? And we have that conversation. So we talk about things like eating well and exercise, reading, being a lifelong learner, making sure that we're not smoking. Smoking actually is one of it's a great risk factor for many things. Understanding just really where we are as far as if we have any health concerns, knowing your numbers and having those conversations with your doctor on a regular basis to make sure that, you know, if you have diabetes or if you have high cholesterol, all of those things are being managed. We talk a lot about what's healthy for our heart is also healthy for our brains. So having those conversations and thinking about what you can do to drive down that risk is really great. And then two, with the conversations with kids maybe at home, talk about dementia, talk about Alzheimer's, talk about what it is, know the difference, and, you know, seek some education. We've got some great classes that anyone can join for free. Again, none of our services are cost a dime.
Tony, we have about 30 seconds left. I laugh with my kids and I tell them, hey, look, technology is going to be our friend here. We're going to be able to pop a robot in my house to really do a lot of things for me. That's cool. And they're saying, are you nuts? And I'm thinking, no. So my question is technology going to help us here?
Oh, I think so. You know, already we're looking at implementing AI into services that we provide. And, you know, the world in the future is our oyster. So I think that we're going to see a lot of really cool technology. And we already have some really cool technology to help people living with dementia currently. But we're going to see some really fun stuff in the future. I'm excited for that.
Joan Danks, she's the North Dakota Program Director for the Alzheimer's Association. Joan, how can people get in touch with you?
You know, you can go online. Our Minnesota North Dakota chapter up here, you can go online at alz.org/MNND. And you can certainly call any of our offices. And a good number to reach us at here is 701-258-4933.
Joan, thanks for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you so much, Craig.
Larry Chouinard is my former high school social studies teacher, and I thought it would be fun to check in with Larry and welcome him to Main Street. Larry, it's good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's good to hear you again. It's been a little while.
So Larry taught me. He taught my kids in high school, and he also took maybe, what, Larry, 30, 35 groups of Riverton, Wyoming high school students to Washington every year as part of the close-up program.
It was a great experience taking all those students back there and watch their growth and a better understanding of how a democracy works.
So Larry, what are you thinking about when you think about your former students today, this election season that we've just been in, and now here we are on election day? What's going through your mind, Larry?
I'm hoping that a lot of people come to the polls and express their views through their ballot. It's a democracy, and the democracy is built on participation of the population. And I'm just hoping my former students go to the poll and vote their choice.
Larry, what's on your mind relative to our nation's future? I know that you've given it some good thought. Are you still as bright-eyed as you used to be about our country's democracy?
I'm nervous, but I'm still bright-eyed because I believe in democracy and I believe in people participating. I get very nervous when I see some of the statements made by someone in one party to the other, dehumanizing. I remember sitting and listening to the news the other night where one of the candidates said that we need to punish the people who are involved in abortion. And I wondered if that was the women or the doctors or everybody. And I think it's extreme right now, and I get very nervous about that.
Sure.
Our founding fathers believe that a free press is essential, the cornerstone of democracy. And a democracy really can't survive if it's not compromised. And that's what frightens me the most.
You've watched a generation of students now come into this very, very divided country. It wasn't the same, I don't believe, when you were teaching me social studies in high school. What's changed so much, Larry?
When I was teaching you or your children, I presented both sides of the issues with both parties as equally balanced as I possibly could so they could make a decision based on what they could find out there to support those positions. And looking out there right now, I would find that very, very difficult, because I think in the class I would be teaching, they've already made a decision. They're in a party, not in the party. They made their choices, and they're not going to move from where they are.
Larry, would you be able to teach me today like you were able to teach me more than 40 years ago, Larry?
That's a great question, because in class when you were with me or your children or others, we based our ideas on civility. I may not agree with you, but I wouldn't put you down for your beliefs. And right now it seems like people slam each other for their beliefs. And I'd be very nervous in class trying to get make sure I was as balanced as I possibly could be, but I don't know if it would work at this point right now.
Well, Larry, it's great to hear your voice. You and your wife were just given the great award of being the Riverton, Wyoming Citizens of the Year. Your wife, Mary Jo, also a longtime educator. You dedicated your life to educating me and my children. I've told you before, but I'll tell you again, I'm grateful for that. And it's really good to hear your voice here on Main Street. Thank you so much for joining me, Larry.
Well, it's a pleasure to do that, and let's stay in touch.
I like that idea.
Coming up, a preview of Asian View, a new segment airing on Prairie Public. And we'll hear from Tom Ezern. That's next. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Asian View is a new segment broadcast by NHK World Japan. You can listen to Asian View and get the latest information from a region that's playing an increasingly important role in the world every day at 5:44 p.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public. Raja Pradhan is the host of Asian View, and he is my guest. Raja, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
Raja, why was it important for Asian View to be heard here in North Dakota?
Well, I mean, first I should explain Asian View, the program, is an international news segment produced by NHK World Japan, and that's part of NHK, which is Japan's only public media organization. And Asian View is a five-minute program that features the latest news and deep analysis from Japan and the rest of Asia. And what I think it's particularly important is that it gives that Asian perspective, something you can't get elsewhere.
Give me an example of what our listeners can expect to hear from you. How do you select the stories that you bring to our airwaves?
Basically, Asian View covers a broad range of topics, including politics, business, technology, and even culture, and you name it. If it happens anywhere in Asia, we're interested. For example, a typical week may see us broadcast stories on topics as varied as concerns over China's growing presence in the East and South China Seas, North Korea's nuclear and missile development in violation of relevant UN Security Council resolutions. And we also have efforts in Japan to bring home all the Japanese nationals who were abducted to North Korea in the 1970s and 80s.
We hear stories about North Korea, of Taiwan. How is your perspective different from what we hear in the Western media?
Regarding North Korea, we just had a possible projectile just flying in the air a couple hours ago, you know, right before our broadcast. And this is something that we are always prepared for. And at NHK World Japan, we have a system called J-Alert, also for NHK Domestic. But we always are always ready because we need to know if that possible ballistic missile or projectile is flying over Japan or coming towards Japan. And this is something that the whole nation is always keeping an eye on. And I think this is important because it's what we experience here in Japan. And that's what we can put that on our scripts and make it easy for people in North Dakota to understand.
Give us a sense, Raja, of public broadcasting in Japan. I assume there are many commercial vendors of information, of music, of entertainment, and there's also public broadcasting. What Yes. is public broadcasting in Japan?
Well, public broadcasting is basically only through NHK. What we do at Asian View is we do it for our U.S. viewers, our international viewers as well, and we make everything in Japan and the rest of Asia as easy as possible to understand. And that's why, Asian View, I believe, is a very unique program to give that perspective from Asia. You know, we cover news from Japan and neighboring countries, including China, North Korea, even Southeast Asia, like Indonesia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Myanmar as well. We even covered the big news about the Nobel Peace Prize, which was just weeks ago. And we had the atomic bomb survivors known as Hibakusha, that organization representing those survivors, winning this year's Nobel Peace Prize. And they'll be in Norway, I believe, soon to receive that award. We've also covered the Nobel, Ig Nobel Prize in Physiology, and this is something that Japan often receives the past few years. This time it was about a team of Japanese and U.S. researchers discovering that pigs and other mammals are capable of breathing through their anuses, and that was a pretty interesting story. We recently actually covered a story on bullet climbing, and this is regarding Mount Fuji. I'm sure many people know Japan's highest peak, and bullet climbing just started recently, and it's people go heading to the summit of Mount Fuji overnight to see the sunrise at the peak without taking sufficient rest. And this has been quite some news in Japan, because local authorities are warning that, you know, doing that bullet climbing, such a practice would increase the risk of accidents, hypothermia, and it's been quite a trend, because people do that with that risk. And yeah, that's one thing that's very interesting. And another thing is that I also do the play-by-play for Grand Sumo, and that is something actually that many people are very interested in. And I think a lot of fans in the United States who crave sumo, and I think the tradition of all the history behind Japan's traditional sport is very intriguing to viewers.
Okay, Raja, I don't know much about sumo wrestling, and I'm guessing that most Americans really don't either. So in Japanese, give me an exciting sports call about something that just happened.
Okay. So when a match starts, we start with hakkyoi nokota, and that's what the gyoji, the referee in the middle, says. So he says, hakkyoi nokota, nokota. Nokota means stay in the ring. And the rikishi battle it out, and they go. The match continues, and at the end it says, oshite, oshite, yorikitta, yorikitta, frontal force out, a yorikiri victory for Ozeki Onosato. That's the kind of way that's how we end the match.
How important is sumo wrestling to Japan? Is it like football is in America?
Yes, it is. It is. Grand Sumo is held every other month, every odd month. So there's six tournaments throughout the year, and it's something that everybody watches. More young people are starting to be fascinated by the sport, but people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, they came from that era of Grand Sumo when it was really big, when it started to be really big. Grand Sumo dates back more than hundreds of years, but yeah, even now, it's the traditional customs. Everything is very intriguing, and people across Japan love it.
What don't I know about Shohei Ohtani?
I'm a big baseball fan, actually, and I've been following Shohei from when he was in high school. He grew up in Iwate Prefecture in northeastern Japan, and he was already ready for big things. And he's been a trailblazer from his teenage days. But yeah, the people back home in Iwate, he comes from a city called Oshu. And yeah, Shohei Ohtani is just, he's been really big from before. He was a pitcher batting cleanup, I believe, in high school. Seeing the Dodgers seal the deal just last week was just exciting for me, as it was for everybody in Japan.
Back to the show Asian View. How do you balance news and culture in what it is that you bring to us now here in North Dakota?
Well, for everybody in North Dakota, all our U.S. Viewers, we try to have a segment we have our news lineup every day of the weekday from Monday through Friday. But we also have a wide range of feature stories that we broadcast on Wednesdays and Fridays. And that's to shed light on what's happening in Japan and across Asia, of course. And we've not just had a lineup of our news stories like North Korea, China. It's not just that. We've been featuring an interview on Wednesdays and Fridays on many things that are going on across Asia. So, for example, we recently featured an interview on how serious the use of deepfake technology is to create fake sexual images and share them on messaging apps in South Korea. That's one. Another report we had was the growing concern in Japan about problems associated with so-called host clubs. And that's where women pay for male companionship. and female customers are often charged excessive fees, and that's leading to some to resort to prostitution to pay their debts. So many of those deep news that only people in Asia can understand and, you know, make it into a script. That's what we try to incorporate and culminate into 5 minutes, because unfortunately our segment at the moment is just 5 minutes, and we have to make sure we balance that. But we have that interview twice a week to make it interesting for our viewers.
What's your background, Raja? You have not been a journalist your entire professional life?
Sure. I was born and raised here in Japan, but I went to an international school in Tokyo through high school. I then spent 4 years studying at a university in Virginia. And at that time, I had no intention of becoming an announcer or having any type of job in the media, actually. But I did know I love communicating with people. I wanted to use my English, Japanese, and some of my French skills for my profession. And that's why, Craig, the very first job I landed after returning to Japan after university was a flight attendant at a European airline. Yeah, it was actually a perfect fit for me because, you know, what's more, I just love to travel and was great with jet lag, too. So, yeah.
Your favorite European city is?
I should say Amsterdam. I love the canals. I love the scenery. And I flew there most of my 5 years in my career flying. Yeah, I got to say, I love Heineken too.
Right there with you. Right there with you. So there came a moment though that it was time to leave that profession. What happened next?
The thing is that, you know, I had no experience in the world of broadcasting, but while I was flying, I was able to also read the news on radio through an acquaintance. And I actually started my media career on the radio, just like we're doing now. The most critical turning point in my life arrived on March 11th, 2011. That's the powerful earthquake and tsunami that struck northeastern Japan. And at that time, the jolt came at 2:46 p.m. I believe it was a Friday. And it came right when I was doing a narration job at NHK. And I was asked if I can head to the disaster area the next morning on March 12th as a reporter. And I said yes immediately because I really felt a sense of mission and wanted to see what I can do under those circumstances. And that's why I headed to northeastern Japan the next morning. And I saw the devastation firsthand, and I was able to report and talk to people who had to evacuate after the disaster. And that really made me think about the gravity of the situation and how much each word coming out of my mouth on live television meant. So this really led to me to pursue my career only in broadcasting. I realized this is the job I want to do for the rest of my life. Also, the same year, I kicked off my sumo commentary. Yeah, now I'm able to do the news, TV newscast. I love my radio shifts that I do on Asian View as well. You know, I think radio, it was my gateway to broadcasting. So I want to continue this as long as I can and continue to serve as a bridge between Japan and the world.
How do people consume radio in Japan?
Radio is actually still very used by people across Japan. I think it's a podcast that we have for Asian View as well. There's another domestic channel that we have that is like podcast. And that's how people are able to listen to Asian View as well. And I think our Asian View is also broadcast, I think, every weekday, and that's through another domestic channel. So there are actually many foreigners in Japan that listen to our show to get the latest on Japanese news in English. So it's not just through TV, like where I work, NHK World Japan as well. Many people still use radio, especially when they're on the train, on their way to work or school. Many people are trying to get news in English out of Japan, as well as many students. I've had a couple students who've encountered me and saying that they listen to our show to study English.
How are you funded in Japan? What is the economic resources that you are able to cultivate in order to have a strong presence in Japan?
The sole public radio and TV station, we are getting funded through the fees that all the citizens, through this everybody living in Japan.
So folks in Japan have a public broadcasting fee of sorts?
Yes, yes. Either monthly or yearly, they can choose. Because of that, we're able to have all the resources and, you know, have all the various types of broadcasts every day.
What's your vision for Asian View, Raja?
Where will it be in 5 years, in 10 years?
Yeah, I guess if we look at the history first, we launched our first public broadcast in November 2019 at a public radio station in the U.S. So it's been exactly 5 years now. And it really was a deeply moving moment because we're able to bring that Asian perspective to our American listeners. And it felt like a significant milestone for NHK. You know, as I mentioned, it's broadcast Monday through Friday. It's now on over 240 public radio stations across the U.S. and Canada, including Prairie Public. So we're really delighted to bring the program to listeners in North Dakota. And yeah, as you mentioned, looking ahead, we aim to expand Asian View to more public radio stations. Maybe our next goal is 250. Yeah, we hope to continue sharing the diverse Asian perspectives with a wider audience.
The program is Asian View. It's a 5-minute news segment broadcast by NHK World Japan. Raja, best wishes. It's been a pleasure.
It really was. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you, Craig.
The North Dakota Council on the Arts, in collaboration with the state governor's office, invites the public to submit nominations for the 2025 Governor's Awards for the Arts, honoring those who have made significant contributions to the arts in our state. Details on how to nominate an artist or arts-related organization can be found online at arts.nd.gov. Nominations are open until December 6, 2024, with an award ceremony at the Heritage Center in Bismarck on February 6, 2025.
Tom Eason's Plains Folk essay explores the enduring social and cultural legacy of Great Plains homesteading, highlighting how the Homestead Act fostered communities rooted in democratic values, personal responsibility, and aspirational virtues, transforming both the landscape and the character of its people.
I've been arguing, along with Richard Edwards in his new book, Great Plains Homesteaders, that we should rethink our history with the Homestead Act on the Great Plains. You can do some of this for yourself, of course. If you have a homesteading ancestor, then you can order up the land patent file from the National Archives and learn the gritty details of proving up. You can scroll through the digitized pages of your local and regional newspapers and watch the notices of final proof blink in across the landscape like farmyard lights at prairie dusk. I'm really thinking, though, with Edwards, about how we think about these things, what they mean to us as the heirs of this land and this history. In his conclusion, The Homesteader's Legacy, Edwards walks us through the process. Sure, he says, the onset of technological process and the erosion of international markets have degraded the numbers and status of family farms in the region. But in its heyday, Edwards declares, homesteading was a powerful force. As for the legacies of that force, he observes, many family farms today, whatever their scale or technological sophistication, trace their origins to their ancestors' homesteads. Homesteading's most visible legacy, we read, was the physical transformation of the land. Some of this we today regret. However, few in American society challenged the plow up, and most cheered. Few saw the grassland as something worth saving. By this process, the homesteaders transformed the Great Plains into a food-producing colossus, quoting Jacob still here, also a surplus-producing colossus, we might add, putting too many of us out of business. So far, it sounds like a wash. But now, unexpectedly, Jacob shifts the calculus to the social and, I dare say, national benefits of the Homestead Act. First, it generated local communities that were deeply committed to democratic customs. Homesteaders swore affidavits for one another at the land office, fought prairie fires, built schools and school boards, comported themselves as small property owners who were much more egalitarian than our modern culture is. Well, sure, they had their community conflicts, even homicidal ones. Edwards tells us the story of a young neighbor of his ancestors in Montreal County who courted a girl from the Finnish settlement, got himself thrown into a well for his trouble. A story I intend to look into, but not to gainsay how more positively, as Edwards says, Homesteading fostered a distinctive way of thinking about and behaving in the world. It fostered a belief in how an upstanding person ought to behave in the world. It encouraged character traits, call them virtues for lack of a better word, that people of the region admired in others and strived to achieve in themselves. Resolution, steadfastness, modesty, optimism, a spirit of adventure. This constellation of virtues is how they wanted to be. Aspirational values, we would say today. This is the legacy the homesteaders bequeathed us, Edwards says. So if, as at present in our national society, it celebrates wealth and celebrity and being a winner and belittling others, people will scramble to achieve those attributes. The homesteading generation celebrated a different set of personal virtues, ones centered on personal responsibility, honesty, and modesty. This is the legacy the homesteaders bequeathed us. My own immersion in historical documentation confirms Jacob's assessment as to these virtues. If we scan the prairies and do not see them today, then that's on us, not on the homesteaders.
That was Tom Ezern. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he has shared over 1,000 Plainsfolk essays with us.
Hi, it's Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. You may have heard that prices for used vehicles are up. That car you've been thinking about donating to this station?
That car could be worth hundreds of dollars or even more in support.
If you don't need it, donate it. It's easy, it's free to you, and the proceeds help us bring you the news.
Learn more on this station's website.
Just go to prairiepublic.org, open the support tab, and choose vehicle donation.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 5th. When the Civil War ended, Ulysses S. Grant was a national hero and a logical candidate for president. He won the election of 1868. On this date, in 1872, he won a second term in an election that had major ramifications for Dakota Territory. The 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty designated the Black Hills as the Great Sioux Reservation, off limits to whites. But in 1874, Grant approved an expedition into the Black Hills, led by Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. Custer's mission, to find a new site for a new army post, was permitted, but searching for gold was not. When Custer claimed to have found gold, prospectors made a beeline to what quickly became known as the New El Dorado. At the time, the United States was in the second year of an economic depression. As miners swarmed into the Black Hills, Western newspapers and congressmen demanded that Grant annex the entire reservation. The Lakota held the Black Hills in high esteem and were alarmed by the incursion of the prospectors. Grant had taken office committed to a peace policy. He found himself forced to choose between the Indians, who had not yet gained the right to vote, and Americans, who would be voting in the next election. Grant chose the latter. When Lakota chiefs went to Washington to protest the incursion by prospectors, Grant told them he had no power to prevent miners from moving into the Black Hills. The chiefs were disgusted and disappointed by Grant's response as they returned to the reservation. In 1875, a commission went to the Black Hills in one last attempt at negotiation. Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, two very influential chiefs, refused to participate. The commission returned to Washington, telling Grant that his ample and liberal offer had been refused. Grant abandoned his peace policy, and a year later, Custer led the 7th Cavalry out of Fort Abraham Lincoln to the massacre at Little Bighorn. In 1980, the Supreme Court ruled that the Lakota were entitled to damages for the loss of their land. The Lakota have never collected the money, which has grown to more than $1 billion with interest. They say the Black Hills are not for sale. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's a wrap for this Election Day edition of Main Street. Thank you for spending part of your day with us, and we hope voting is on your to-do list today. Tomorrow, we're excited to welcome back our go-to presidential historian, Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane from Dickinson State University, for an insightful post-election conversation. Plus, our news director, Dave Thompson, and I will break down what the local election results mean to us here in North Dakota. Join us again tomorrow on Main Street. We look forward to having you with us.